coming up on Weekend America.
Here's a conversation you don't get to hear over the grill on July 4th.
He and I certainly would have a joking conversation about the irony of this being Independence Day, and yet it symbolizes the beginnings of the dominance of the Euro culture, if you will.
This weekend, how independence plays in Indian country. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. Later, what to do when your kid's hot dog gets a little scorched this weekend.
I try very hard not to talk her out of the rough spots of life. I try to make it clear to her that it's okay to feel pain. This is a normal part of life.
The pros and cons of a melancholy baby. And this Independence Day, a refugee in America is discovering the cost of freedom.
Now I have my own home and I have to pay for everything, like electricity, gas, water, and rent.
It's a price he's glad to pay. Coming up on Week in America.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. In St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper.
And also in St. Paul, I'm John Moe, in for Bill Radke. This 4th of July weekend, we are celebrating America by bringing you all sorts of stories from all across this land of ours, from a First Amendment squabble over what to name a sewage treatment plant, to a first weekend of freedom for a Burmese family resettling in Texas. We'll also hear from descendants of people who were here long before George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and those other guys, how American Indians are celebrating the 4th. So it's fireworks season. Which one's your favorite?
Oh, the ones that they shoot up and then they explode and then they change colors on the way down.
The kind that make that sort of crackling glitter that lasts for a really, really long time and fall down really slowly.
I really don't enjoy fireworks since my experience in Vietnam, but I would like anything that's red, white, and blue clustered.
The Saturn missiles. They are the box with like 50 little missiles in them, and they go everywhere, and they're kind of loud and noisy, so I like those a lot.
Don't look at me. I like them all. They just have to be far, far away. That's
really?
All I care about.
You don't enjoy the rocket's red glare too.
I don't want the lawn
you.
On fire, no. that's not fun.
It's not part of the pyrotechnic display. I like the woman who said that she likes the ones that shoot up and explode.
Oh, those.
You know, those fireworks, the exploding kind. Those voices came to us from Chicago and also from Morgantown, West Virginia.
Well, this 4th of July, we celebrate what makes us uniquely American, like the constant influx into this country of people from all over the world. This weekend, we bring you another in our continuing series of First Weekend Home. Now, typically, those stories have been about soldiers in their first weekends when they come home from the war. But this weekend, we follow an immigrant family that's seeing home for the first time in America. Reporter Tori Marlin brings us the story of a family of refugees from Burma, now called Myanmar. And this is the first of many weekends that they hope to spend in Austin, Texas.
Just a week ago, Burmese exiles Thot Thi Thu, his wife Nolahe, and their three children were living in a refugee camp in Thailand. Now they're sitting in the back of a strip mall office in Austin, listening to a volunteer for Refugee Services of Texas teach them basic survival skills, like how to call 911.
When you say 911, they understand it's an emergency. I'm going to learn this English word, help. 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 Yeah, everybody just say it once. Help. Help. Help.
Okay. Help is something the family will need a lot of in the coming days and weeks. Thot Thi worked as a rice farmer in Burma, not exactly a marketable skill here. He's part of the Karen ethnic minority, which came under particular attack when a military junta seized power in 1988.
Burmese soldiers forced me to work for them. And that's the worst thing, because I don't have time to work to support my family. I just have to work for them.
The soldiers burned down their village, and the couple fled with their children. They walked through the jungle for 2 weeks until they reached a refugee camp in Thailand. There they lived for the next 10 years in a small bamboo hut, cooking with wood, relying on candlelight, and sleeping on floor mats.
Hi, welcome. Welcome.
Now, Sophia Cassini, the director of Refugee Services of Texas in Austin, shows them around their new two-bedroom apartment.
This is to turn on the light for the electricity.
The family crouches under a lamp, wrapped as Cassini brightens and darkens the room. She invites the couple's 18-year-old daughter, Seta Ble, to give it a try. The girl has trouble with the twisting motion.
Do this way.
The light.
Finally, she gets it.
Yeah, good. And then do it again. Come and try it again.
Seta has a harder time with her bed. She's used to the floor, so that's where she sleeps. The comforts of their new home impress her mother more.
In the camp, I have to go and fetch the water, and everything is difficult for me. But in here, I can get the water easy, and everything is perfect for me, and like chair, sofa, is very nice for me.
Nola and her husband no longer have to collect their own water, but almost everything else is a challenge. Cassini is there to help.
The first thing you want to do is connect them to food stamps, Medicaid, Social Security, and then as they're able to become more self-sufficient, they may or may not need it in the future, and the ultimate goal is that they won't.
Fathi and Nola will also need help finding jobs, enrolling their kids in school, recognizing food in a supermarket. Even a takeout menu left outside their door has the power to confound. They show it to their caseworker, in case it's important. Anticipating these kinds of problems, Cassini has placed them in an apartment complex with other Burmese refugees who can ease their transition.
They don't like to isolate people. There are different philosophies, but I try very hard to put people where there's going to be other groups of either refugees or just immigrants from their home community.
So Cassini has arranged for a Karen neighbor named Mumu to have lunch with the family on its first Saturday here. Fathi welcomes her at the door with a few English words he's recently learned. But as soon as they sit down for black pepper soup, they start chatting away in Karen. They swap jet lag stories, and Mumu tells them where to buy fish paste. Making friends doesn't seem to be a problem for Fathi. He's already met two other families in the apartment complex.
If I see other people who look like refugees, I just go and ask, like, where are you from? Are you a refugee? If you are, we are friends.
Their Burmese neighbors prove that starting over is possible. The family is expected to support itself within 6 months. That makes Fathi a little nervous. He's not used to paying bills.
Now I have my own home and I have to pay for everything, like electricity, gas, water, and rent.
But his worries are small compared to the ones he had in Burma. And he's had more freedom in the last couple of days than he did in the previous 10 years. He marvels at the changes in his life.
It's safe here and peaceful, so I'm happy to stay here forever.
The family knows that it will take time to settle in. For now, though, they're feeling hopeful. Fathi has found work. He's cleaning hotel rooms downtown. And their daughter, Seta, is finally sleeping in her bed. In Austin, Texas, I'm Tori Marlin for Weekend America.
Well, this 4th of July weekend, maybe you're doing one of those all-American activities, hosting a barbecue, going to a ball game, maybe eating apple pie or hot dogs, though hopefully not simultaneously. Or maybe you're being a real patriot and championing democracy, trying to get someone to sign your petition, or walking quickly away from someone who's trying to get you to sign their petition. But in San Francisco this weekend, one group of petitioners is having no problem gathering signatures for a special and, I would say, historically odd political ballot initiative. We sent reporter Roman Mars to find out what's going on.
2 years ago, the people of San Francisco voted on Proposition J, which would make it the city's official policy to call for the impeachment of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. It passed with 59% of the vote. But that wasn't enough for some. A new group known as the Presidential Memorial Commission of San Francisco wants to make a permanent statement about how people here feel about the Bush administration.
This is a very rare initiative, and the people will actually line up to sign it. We can get hundreds in a day, no problem.
You let them catch a glimpse of the sign, and they just come up to you and they want to hug you.
What is it that you're signing here?
I'm signing an initiative to rename our sewage plant the George W. Bush Sewage Plant. It's, I think, a great tribute to him.
The initiative co-authors are fixtures around the city now. Brian McConnell and Michael Jacinto fan out on the busy street corner of Church and Market, blaring patriotic music and carrying an American flag. They're already well past the number of signatures required to get on the ballot, but they're getting a few more for good measure. What started as a joke over beers has turned into a movement. With a dedicated group of volunteers, weekly gatherings, and costume street theater-style signature drives, they're having a great time, but not everyone is.
The first thing that came into my mind is another group of nuts putting something on the San Francisco ballot again.
That's Howard Epstein, chairman of the San Francisco Republican Party.
You know, there's a lot of people who don't like the president, but this isn't the way to do it.
Epstein vows to do everything he can to defeat the initiative, including get out the vote campaigns and speaking at every neighborhood group in the city. But they might want to consider joining forces with another party that's a little uneasy about the name change.
My name is Tony Winokur, and I'm the spokesperson for the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. The clear intent behind the backers of the initiative is to make negative statements about the president. You know, we think what voters may want to ask themselves is an award-winning treatment plant that's never had a single environmental violation the right thing to name after President Bush?
Brian McConnell understands the Utility Commission's concerns, but the opportunity for San Francisco to comment on the Bush legacy is too important.
50 years from now, there'll be a kid somewhere in a civics class learning about Mount Rushmore and Abraham Lincoln on the $5 bill and the George W. Bush sewage plant. They'll get it. And it will lead to a discussion about Iraq and, you know, $10 trillion debt and just, you know, the whole legacy that he left the country. One of the things we want to do is set a precedent for politicians that, you know, if you really screw up, and especially if you betray the trust of the public, there's lots of places that could be named after you, and they're not libraries.
In fact, talk has already begun about the treatment plant's renaming, set for January 20th, Inauguration Day next year. Spokesperson Tony Winokur says the Public Utility Commission is going to roll with it.
It's quite possible that should it pass, we'll have a dedication ceremony, as would be appropriate for the renaming of any major facility, and maybe we'll even invite the president, who at that point might have a little more time on his hands.
What do you imagine the scene will be like on January 20th at the formerly Oceanside Water Pollution Control Plant?
Mission accomplished.
We'll make sure there's a big mission accomplished banner. We'll find a flight suit.
In San Francisco, and only in San Francisco, I'm Roman Mars for Weekend America.
And petition gatherers are well stocked with extra supplies of irony, and they're on the streets of San Francisco this weekend. Kind of makes you wonder how that measure would do in Crawford, Texas.
I wouldn't try it.
I don't think so.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Is your baby girl unhappy? Well, maybe that's just good enough for her. No, really. What if being sad isn't such a bad thing? Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, we hope you're having a great time this holiday weekend. But you know what? Even if you're tickled pink, you're probably not as happy as all the people in Denmark. This week, a study revealed that Denmark is the happiest place on the planet. In case you wanted to know, the United States is about 16th. Zimbabwe is the gloomiest of the glum. What seems to make a really happy nation is economic growth, a little bit of democratic principles, and social tolerance. And that's from the World Value Surveys. They've been conducting those surveys for about 26 years. And although they give you a peek into world values, Weekend America's Bill Radke is a little more concerned with family values. His daughter Susanna turned 17 months this weekend, and he's questioning his own need to make sure she's happy.
As I've been doing this series about parental values, the question that keeps coming up is, which values are going to help my kid be happy? That's been my test. Forget conventional wisdom. Is this going to foster my daughter's happiness? Of course, I've just been taking it for granted that good old American happiness is a noble goal.
I think that's not a noble goal. I think it's a rather destructive goal that can lead to a pretty attenuated life.
This is Eric Wilson. He's an English professor at Wake Forest University and author of the book Against Happiness. And he's a father, too. His daughter is six. Eric is inclined to melancholy. When he was a kid, his parents encouraged him to lighten up. Stop overthinking it, Eric. Be happy. That's something he never says to his little girl.
I try very hard not to talk her out of the rough spots of life. I try to make it clear to her that it's okay to feel pain. This is a normal part of life. We shouldn't try to convince ourselves that the pain isn't really there. I guess the best way I can put this is I want her to be realistic.
What does she ask you about sadness?
She was very interested a few weeks ago in the fact that my favorite color is black. Hers is pink. And we did get into a bit of a conversation about how I like black because I like to brood. I like to sit in dark rooms and think. I like twilight. And she seemed a little bemused at the time, not seeming to understand. But I will note that since that time, she has said that her favorite color is black as well. So
how do you feel about that, Eric?
Has taken place.
Do you have any conflict about turning your child's favorite color from pink to black?
Well, my great intellectual hero is, I'm sad to say, Hamlet. But his black garb didn't do him much good. I think I'll try to encourage something like chartreuse over the next few weeks, and we'll see what happens.
So he's being lighthearted here, but this is a challenging conversation for me. Eric is saying that sadness, discontent, anger are healthy responses to an unjust world. Unhappiness is what inspires us to change the world. But the thing is, I've been unhappy, and I have felt it drag me down. I was sort of hoping to protect my kid from this poisonous idea that the world is wrong. So I asked Eric, how do you know you have to get upset about the world in order to change it? Couldn't you accept the world and then say, and here's another idea?
I think in some ways you hit upon a real tension in the book, a tension I was not aware of when I was writing the book. On the one hand, there is this sense, and it's something of a Judeo-Christian sense, that the world is fallen. It's kind of botched. It's corrupt. But on the other hand, there's another way of looking at the world, which tends to be a little more Eastern, and I think it is sort of what you're talking about, that, yeah, you accept the world as it is. It's a wonderful dance between creation, destruction, death, and life. And that's what it is. There's no reason to get upset about it.
So what about these Eastern ideas? Buddhism, Taoism, what do they have to say about unhappiness and raising children? There's a place in Miami Beach called the Institute for Mindfulness Studies. Mindfulness is a central Buddhist teaching. It basically means awareness. When something happens, your brain generates a story about it. When you get caught up in that story, you lose awareness of the present, of reality, of the child who's standing in front of you. The director of the Institute for Mindfulness Studies is Scott Rogers. He wrote a book called The Mindful Parent. He also has a little girl. And he gave me an example. His mother died recently at the age of 70.
And not that long ago, I was sitting at the kitchen table and thoughts of my mother had come into my mind, and I was beginning to get a little sad. And my daughter Rose saw that and came over, and she began to cry, and she gave me a hug, and it was a very tender moment. And because I was there and I wanted to be there for my child and I wanted to be able to talk with my child about this experience of loss, what naturally arose was how grateful and how wonderful it was to spend so much time with Grandma.
And Scott, that early regret, that's so achingly beautiful and true. Did you not feel like you lost anything by not dwelling longer in the beauty of that sad truth?
Right. See, that's a very interesting phrasing, the beauty of that sad truth, because there is something compelling sometimes about staying with a feeling state that is tender. I think that regretting is moving in a direction that's not genuine. It's a genuine thought, but it's not fulfilling. And because it tends to lead to a sad feeling and not a neutral or a happy feeling, it creates the question of whether or not moving there is present and genuine, or whether moving there is the trick of the mind to create ultimately a sad state that need not arise.
Last weekend, I got together with a friend of mine and her 14-year-old daughter. And this young lady was livid at how her preferred presidential candidate was getting treated in her mind. She was thundering about this. Why doesn't he fight back just as dirty? I told Scott Rogers that story, and he told me that even politically engaged anger is stuck in the past. Look what Bush did. Look what the Democrats did. It's all been done. The question is, what is she doing now to create the world that she wants?
We can spend a lot of productive time ranting and raving to soothe this not liking what has already taken place. Or we can craft it and articulate it and move forward in a way that does something about it.
I think her mom was a little proud. Well, I was disturbed. I think mom was proud. I think she feels like, yeah, she's caught up. This is the anger that gets things changed in the world.
Right. Well, we love it when our children are inspired and she's right. She's right. I think the question is that we have a lot of people who are inspired to make change, and then they can go in different directions based on how they do that. Some are productive and some can go astray.
You know, so far my 17-month-old daughter's anguish comes from not being able to put a puzzle together. And even there, my instinct is to right away help her with that puzzle, stop those tears. But what about all of the other puzzles, a whole life ahead of her where things will not fit the way she'd like? I agree with Scott Rogers that the mindful person understands that our frustration with the world comes from us, not the world. But he and Eric Wilson believe something in common. And that is, just because my daughter's unhappiness is in her mind doesn't mean it isn't real. Together, maybe she and I can recognize anguish and appreciate it as a welcome guest who knows when to leave. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can comment on this piece and listen to my whole series about values at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
July 4th might be this nation's birthday, but there were nations here before it. Independence Day on the Reservation, coming up on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. What is the soundtrack to your weekend? We've been asking you that for a while now. We've received all sorts of responses, wide range of musical genres, but the Americans we usually talk to are generally in America. This week, we travel abroad. James Dewey Dewhurst is a former National Guardsman from Louisiana and is now a private contractor in Afghanistan, 11 miles from the Pakistani border. His weekend soundtrack is Aquamarine by Carlos Santana. He found the soundtrack to his weekend when he was on R&R leave in Negril, Jamaica. I'm no world traveler, but from what I understand, Jamaica is pretty different from Afghanistan. When were you last in Jamaica?
If I remember correctly, back in March of 2005. Yeah, I flew from Afghanistan to Dubai, from Dubai to London, England, from London, England to Jamaica. So it's quite a contrast that in the space of 2-3 days, you're suddenly seeing blue Gulf water, crystal clear. It's gorgeous, and you got to have your red stripe beer.
How did this song by Carlos Santana enter into the equation?
A couple of Jamaican fellas pulled up in a boat and asked if anyone wanted to go snorkeling. And so I jumped at the chance, and the whole time I'm snorkeling, this song's just playing in my head. I'm like, wow, talk about music that just fits this Jacques Cousteau moment, you know?
These guys on the boat that offered to take you snorkeling, did they offer anything else?
Well, yeah, you get your customary red stripe beer. They were doing another little activity which I didn't partake in, and did have a very pungent smell.
When you're in Afghanistan and you're listening to this song, what are some of the other sounds that you're hearing around there that maybe sometimes you don't even want to necessarily be hearing?
Oh, God, that'd be the mullahs crying out for it's time for prayer. It's pretty wild the way it echoes through the valley. And that's when you're struck that, you know, with the reality, hey, I am not in Louisiana. This is not America. This is not Kansas. That's the best way I can put it, sir.
Is it hard to listen to the song, this Santana song, taking you back to an experience that was so dramatically different from where you're living now? Does it make it harder to make the best of where you are now?
Yes, you do get the effect that I want out of here, I want to go home. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
So when you get that feeling, is that when you turn off the Santana, or is that when you turn up the Santana?
That's when I either turn it up or I switch over to some Dr. John and put on "Must Have Been the Right Place, But It Must Have Been the Wrong Time" kind of song.
Dewey, thanks for sharing the soundtrack of what functions as your weekend.
Hey, and thank you for sharing your weekend with me.
Well, that's Dewey's soundtrack. What's yours? What's the song that brings back memories of weekends long ago? Or that tune that you live by this very weekend right now? The heavy rotation song to your weekend. We want to hear it. We want to play it for America. We want to sing along. Get in touch with us, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to the holiday weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper, along with John Moe. We're both coming to you from St. Paul. This weekend, we celebrate our nation's 232nd birthday. But it's not necessarily a celebration for everybody, especially for many of the Indian tribes who lived on this land long before our founding fathers got here. So just how is July 4th handled on the sovereign lands? Weekend America's Chrissy Clark reports.
Charles Hudson is a member of the Mandan Hidatsa tribe, born on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. But by the time he came along in 1959, much of the reservation was under 300 feet of Missouri River water, thanks to a giant dam built by the federal government.
The Garrison Dam, one of the largest dams in the world, relocated most of the people of my tribe, and both my mother and my father had to leave the town that they grew up in, where their families and ancestors had all lived.
This was not the first or the last conflict Charles and his tribe had with American institutions. Sometimes it was little things, like when Charles was going to the local public high school.
The length you could wear your hair, as an example, was heavily regulated. But my goodness, that's nothing compared to the radical oppressions that my mother's generation and her father's generation were going through.
Oppressions based on the motto, kill the Indian to save the man. Restrictions on his family's native language, native customs. Which is why it makes sense that, growing up, the 4th of July would be a dark day for Charles. A sad tribute to the country that tried and tried again to exterminate its native people and their culture. But it wasn't. For Charles, the 4th
meant family, fireworks, you know, you can't wait for the fireworks. And as a kid, you look forward to that kind of celebration.
Charles wasn't alone. Across the Fort Berthold Reservation, what was left of it, people were partying on the 4th of July. Snow cones and barbecues weaved together with older indigenous traditions. Powwows that would last deep into the night.
At the center is the drum. The beat of the drum means everything in the powwow. It signifies the heartbeat of a people. There are different types of dances, ceremonies, giveaways, acknowledgments.
So why were they celebrating?
This is the classic case of making something positive out of, you know, really desperate situations.
Matthew Dennis is a professor of U.S. history who studies the way Americans observe national holidays. He says we can learn a lot about ourselves as a country by looking at how the 4th is celebrated on reservations like Fort Berthold.
I think it's those who have struggled the most and have been forced to be the most creative, like Native Americans, that have the most to teach us. Incredible creativity and resilience.
To understand what he means, we need to go back to the late 18 and early 1900s, when reservations like Fort Berthold were under severe federal rule. At one point, the reservation's white superintendent issued a declaration that read, quote, traditions like dancing
exchanging of presents, traveling from one dance to another, and dancing feasts were being carried out to excess.
He decreed that permission for all native dances must be obtained in writing. But there was a kicker.
He didn't object to gatherings that were on the 4th of July.
The 4th of July, after all, was the time to teach Indians how to become good Americans. Some Indian kids were even reassigned new birthdays to coincide with the 4th. So the Mandan and Hidatsa people who lived at Fort Berthold decided that if the 4th of July was one of the few occasions when they could celebrate their native customs, then why not celebrate the 4th of July? By the early 1900s, the 4th had become a big day on the reservation.
And so they would exploit these opportunities. They'd get up at dawn, start to hold contests of field sports, foot races, horse races. Later in the evening, all kinds of music and singing and dancing. You know, they would exchange gifts and visit friends and initiate people into new societies and do all the sorts of things that they were otherwise prevented from doing under the cover of this patriotic celebration.
That's very cool.
These turn-of-the-century festivities sounded very familiar to Charles Hudson, the Mandan Hidatsa Indian who grew up on Fort Berthold in the 60s.
If a visitor was to go to Fort Berthold today, you would see something very similar to that.
And not just on the Fort Berthold Reservation. For more than a century, the 4th of July has been a big day across Indian country. The Quapaw in Oklahoma, the Ojibwe in Minnesota, the Northern Cheyenne in Montana are just a few tribes that have established big rodeos and powwows on the 4th, celebrating the day, but making it their own.
Happy Independence Day, Victor. Feeling independent today?
Of course, not all tribes or all Indian people have embraced the holiday in the same way. The Onondaga of upstate New York decided a few years ago to stop observing the 4th of July altogether. Right after America declared independence in 1776, George Washington ordered Onondaga villages to be destroyed. They were in the way of the new country.
Wave my hand and poof, the white people are gone. Gone back to where they belong.
The film Smoke Signals by writer Sherman Alexie captured the bitterness the 4th of July can bring for some Native people in this scene between father and son as they drive through the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation where they live.
I'm feeling independent. Wave my hand and the reservation is gone. Tribal school.
My little brother and I, you know, we like to quote different lines from movies and scenes.
Michelle Singer is a member of the Navajo tribe. She says she and her brother laughed out loud when they watched that scene in the movie theater. Michelle has mixed feelings about Independence Day. On the one hand, when she's at Independence Day barbecues with her little brother,
he and I certainly would have a joking conversation about the irony of this being Independence Day, and yet it symbolizes the beginnings of the dominance of the Euro culture, if you will.
On the other hand, her grandfather was a Navajo code talker during World War II, and she relishes the chance that the 4th provides to honor him and his fellow veterans. Native Americans enlist in the military at far higher rates than any other group of Americans. So it all felt a little surreal for Michelle when she found herself a few years ago watching the fireworks gala from the nation's capital at the top of the federal building that houses the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's the same agency that once handed down kill the Indian to save the man policies to her own ancestors. She was working on the staff of a U.S. senator.
I was actually very moved by all the pomp and circumstance. I could hear the, you know, the Washington Philharmonic play and just see this wonderful firework extravaganza going on just above my head in our nation's capital with that beautiful panoramic view that you see down the mall. It was very moving.
Was there any part of you that felt like you were betraying yourself? Like, no, I'm buying into the lie of 4th of July. I'm buying
yeah,
into
there's
the...
a little bit of that self-imposed guilt. Like, I shouldn't really be enjoying this all too much. If anything, I should at least have some, you know, resentment.
But Michelle says more than guilt, she felt humbled. Native Americans didn't even become citizens until 1924. And now, here she was.
You know, we came from homes where our parents didn't have a college education, and here we were in our nation's capital working in some pretty influential positions, and yet we were just these Indian kids.
The birth of this country came with many caveats, but in the glow of those fireworks, it seemed to Michelle like somehow both her countries, her sovereign tribe and the place that issued her passport, might one day figure things out. I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
We have some photos from Michelle's time on that rooftop, July 4th, 1998. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Well, we're officially in road trip season. Remember the road trip? You and your dog doing the blue highways from coast to coast. I've always wanted to do that. I never did. Or maybe something more family-oriented. You know, the parents in the front, the kids in the back punching each other and arguing over who touched who. You've been there. You've driven that one. Maybe it's 99 bottles of beer on the wall or fast food or road maps that you can't refold or I guess GPS systems now on the dashboard.
Or on your cell phone, which is where mine is.
Could be.
But you know, with the gas prices just going through the roof, a lot of folks aren't taking that classic road trip. Some of them are doing the staycations. They're being tourists in their own town. And you know, really, there's something to be said for that because because you don't have to board Rover and Fluffy or find somebody to watch them. No paying for hotels that you're not going to stay in anyway. And you don't have to hear those kids whining from the back seat. Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
We'll get there when we get there. Well, we need your best stories of your summer vacations and your staycations and your road trips and adventures. And it could be from this year or 50 years ago. Doesn't matter. We want to put them on the radio. And maybe it's a story about something that went horribly, horribly wrong on a vacation where the tent collapses and it's raining and you're in a Tim Hortons donut shop in Canada at 5 in the morning. Not that I've been there, but I've been there. We want those stories as well.
Or maybe something that went really, really right. Now, we'll bring over the lemonade and we'll watch the slides with you. So share your stories at our website, weekendamerica.org.
In Liberty, Illinois, it's clear skies, highs in the 80s this weekend. Freedom, Oklahoma has a scorching 100, and it'll be scattered thunderstorms in Patriot, Ohio on 4th of July weekend. For more weather, here's Weekend America's Stephanie Curtis.
Gas prices are ugly. So's the weather in Auburn, New York. Clouds, thunder, 82. Cars are ugly, too, as the Auburn Double Days baseball team hosts awful car night. Finalists drive around the warning track as fans vote. Winner gets $100, equal to their car's value. But what's uglier these days, an old fuel-efficient Pinto or a brand-new luxury SUV? Sun in 81 in Potosi, Wisconsin. Perfect for enjoying a cold brewski and some history ski. It's opening day of the National Brewery Museum, featuring labels, bottles, and cans, and coasters. Like going to a bar, but you can say it's educational. Don't worry, work is already underway on a pretzel museum to open next door. Showers in 61 in Newport, Oregon. Daggummit. The Oregon Coast Geezer Games is a sports contest only open to people over 30 who are apparently geezers. I hate you, Newport, Oregon. There's swimming, tennis, and basketball, plus clam bake. Closing ceremonies will be briefly halted so everyone can watch Matlock. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Stephanie Curtis for Weekend America.
A homeless man loses a room with a view, but he gains a best friend for life. Coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, I'm Desiree Cooper with John Moe. Well, you might be relaxing this 4th of July weekend, but not everybody gets that privilege. That's where our series, Weekend Shift, comes in. It's about those who work the weekend when the rest of us are off the clock. And then there are some people, like David Chalky, who really don't fit into either category. David's unemployed and homeless, and he works odd jobs, sometimes during the week, sometimes on the weekend, whenever he can get it. This weekend, David is caring for rescued animals at a ranch in Washington State. Jenny Asarno brings us his story.
My name is David Chalky. I built a treehouse in Seattle, and I'm known as the Squirrel Man.
The Squirrel Man. The guy is 52 years old and can scamper up a tree. He'd walk around Seattle with a squirrel on his shoulder.
I just love animals. And that's how I became Squirrel Man, because everybody started seeing me with squirrels.
Dave is small and strong. He's got bony cheeks and watery eyes. He wears big wool sweaters and work boots. Dave is quick to cry.
I was originally in 14 foster homes, so I was tossed around a lot, mentally, physically, emotionally, sexually abused.
Dave seems eager to spill his guts to a total stranger.
Money isn't everything. They got to realize money is not.
He can be defensive.
This is my hood. Let's play.
Angry. Dave is also sincere and sweet.
I'm always asking, am I right or wrong? I'm always looking for approval, for justification of what I just said.
Dave had been living in Pittsburgh. He went through a bad divorce and his life unraveled. He moved out to Seattle. He lost a job, then his apartment, his boat, and his car.
And so I wound up homeless, literally homeless, with nothing.
Dave camped out in an empty lot near a quiet residential neighborhood under the highway. It was loud and grimy, but it was right near a lake. He and his ferrets slept in the briars.
I saw this one tree that, yeah, I could put a platform up there. I went over and got some 2x4s, crawled up the tree, found some nails, hammered it up, and it became a house.
The roof was covered with plastic, but the walls were an open lattice. And the view, you looked out over the lake, the sunset, and the hills. Dave had a sink and a blazing potbelly stove, little trinkets all around, dream catchers, lawn chairs, and animal cages.
What happens is people would bring me animals that got hurt, and everybody was rescued. I had all kinds of baby squirrels, families of raccoons, right on my deck. But I fed everybody. It was their home. They were sharing it with me as far as I was concerned.
Dave lived in that treehouse almost 2 years. City social workers came over in the spring and offered Dave a bed in a homeless shelter. Dave said no. Then utility workers came over and asked Dave to come down.
City Light came out and said, we don't want to do it, but we got to get you out of here. I said, I'm here 2 years. No drug use, no booze. I'm just a guy trying to survive.
But the city said no. Dave got 10 days to tear the treehouse down. He became an instant local celebrity.
Talk about a house with a view. But to see it, you have to climb half this tree.
And joining me live here on News Talk 710 Cairo, from his treehouse, is David Chalky.
Dave went on the local Hard Rock station and asked for help. A few neighbors came out, and so did a lot of strangers.
He's been a great neighbor. He's never bothered us for anything.
Brandon Ferrante was there that day. He lived next door.
He's only helped our neighborhood, kept it clean, kept the parking lot safer.
Brandon and some other neighbors found an old RV for Dave.
Well, we couldn't sleep, We just had to calm his heart.
I watched the news, and I saw his story about his treehouse, and they had said that he wanted to live somewhere where he could rescue animals. And I wrote down the email address, jumped up, and emailed his neighbor. And a few days later, they came up and we met. It was like we knew each other forever. We just hit it off very, very well.
Jill, she didn't want to say her last name, gives off a quiet, no-nonsense vibe. She's blonde, in her 50s. She built her home off the grid on a big piece of land in the Cascade Mountains. She's lived there mostly alone for years.
Wild Mountain Ranch is what I named it years ago. When I moved here, I had 8 wolves.
Yes, wolves. They have the run of the house. Most of them have died now of old age. Jill's got a picture of her wolves hanging by the stairs, and she points to one of them.
That was the love of my life. I always told him if he was a man, I'd marry him. Oh, when he died, I wanted to die.
Jill says she'd rather stay home with her animals than do anything else. She's got horses, goats, and rescued pigs that roam wild. She loves her ranch, but it's a lot of work for one woman, and she doesn't have the money to pay help.
We knew each other for about an hour, and I asked her, I said, can I move here? And she says, I want you to come here.
Oh. Oreo. Yeah, yeah.
This is a rescue pig. It's a potbelly pig. It's about 300 pounds right now.
Yes, oh boy, yeah.
He'd hurt you if he wanted to. But animals that you rescue, they're just happy to be needed and wanted, such as quote-unquote me. I'm happier. Want to say hi to horses?
Dave stays for free. In exchange, he helps Jill out.
He has been like a gift from God. I'm just very happy he's here.
I'd like to build a little place out here, you know, to where I feel home. No more tree houses. You know, just something on the ground.
Do you feel like you were rescued?
Yeah, I do. I was rescued by the neighborhood. And the end rescuer is Jill. Taking me in, but I feel it's a two-way street there. I was drowning and she was drowning, and somehow we dragged each other on shore.
Dave walks over to his RV. It's parked in Jill's driveway. Dave and Jill smoke a cigarette, talk about chores, and fret over the wolves. They both say they connect more with animals than people, but they seem to get each other. They're hoping this will be home for a while. Outside Seattle, I'm Jenny Asarno for Weekend America.
And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Remember, you can download a free podcast of our entire program. Just go to weekendamerica.org. Happy 4th of July. Put some dogs on the Barbie for me.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
When you think weekend in a Las Vegas gated community, what comes to mind? Swimming pools, palatial estates, neighbors outside socializing. But what about during a foreclosure crisis?
The break-ins, the busted windows, the mysterious neighbors across the street who don't speak, the broken-down cars.
On the next Weekend America, a foreclosure crisis hits the capital of America's weekend, Las Vegas. Join us.